From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Eddie Palmieri, the great Latin band leader, has just received a Jazz Master's Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. On today's Fresh Air, he'll tell us about his life in music. Also, Zone 1, a zombie story about a plague in Manhattan that turns the infected into the walking dead, is now out in paperback. We talk with author Colson Whitehead. Zombies have been on his mind since he was a kid and saw the movie Dawn of the Dead.
Some people have anxiety dreams about showing up for a class they didn't know they had or having to give a presentation and they're unprepared. I've had zombie anxiety dreams for the last 30 years.
Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new live recording by saxophonist Jesse Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Colson Whitehead's novel Zone 1 came out last year in the middle of a zombie craze, and it became a national bestseller. It's now out in paperback. The book is set in Manhattan after a plague has spread around the world, turning many of the infected into zombies. When the novel begins, the worst of the plague is over, and New York's provisional government is trying to restore some semblance of normal life. The main character, Mark Spitz, is part of a team that's supposed to clean out the remaining zombies. Colson Whitehead is a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. His novel John Henry Days, about a journalist assigned to write about the legendary John Henry, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. His semi-autobiographical novel Sag Harbor is about summering in a middle-class African-American community in the Hamptons. Terry spoke to Colson Whitehead in October when Zone 1 was published in hardback.
Colson Whitehead, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from Zone 1, and you want to just set it up for us?
Sure. In this section, Mark Spitz, our humble protagonist, is hiding out. The end times have come, and he's found a refuge with a woman named Mim in a toy store in Connecticut. And he's mulling over how he got here and trying to process how much the world has changed. The boy that wandered the cellar of his personality still nursed the naive hunger for a life of adventure. As a kid, he'd invented scenarios for adulthood: to outrun a fireball, swing across the air shaft on a wire, dismember the gargoyle army with an enchanted blade that only he could hold. Now he was grown up, and the plague had granted him his wish and rendered it a silly grotesque. It was not so glamorous to spend 2 days doubled over, emptying your guts because you'd gambled on the expired bottle of kiwi juice. All the other kids turned out to be postal workers, roofers, beloved teachers, and died. Mark Spitz was living the dream. Take a bow, Mark Spitz. And then he goes on to think about all the movies and TV shows he loved as a kid and the monsters in them. He loved the subgenre of misunderstood aliens and mechanical men who yearned to love. He'd always seen himself in them, the robots who roved the galaxy in search of the emotion chip, the tentacled things that were, beneath their mottled, puckered membranes, more human than the murderous villagers who hunted them down for their difference. The townspeople, of course, were the real monsters. It was the business of the plague to reveal our family members, friends, and neighbors as the creatures they'd always been. And what had the plague exposed him to be? Mark Spitz endured as the race was killed off one by one. A part of him thrived on the end of the world. How else to explain it? He had a knack for apocalypse. The plague touched them all, blood contact or no. The secret murderers, dormant rapists, and latent fascists were now free to express their ruthless natures. The timid, those who had been stingy with their dreams for themselves, those who came out of the womb scared and remained so, these too found a final stage for their weakness, and in their last breaths were fulfilled. I've always been like this. Now I'm more me.
That's Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Zone 1. So let's talk about the scenario that you've created. What is the plague that destroys so much of New York?
The plague is a zombie plague, and I'm still trying to get over saying zombie out loud so many times a day. And the infected and the dead are about 95% of the population, and then there are the survivors. And the plague is running down. They're rebuilding society. There are camps of survivors here and there across the country. And now they decided to tackle New York. It's an island. You can go through and sweep out the remaining zombies, the plague-ridden wretches. And our hero, Mark Spitz, is part of a team of sweepers. The army has swept out most of the creatures. And Omega Team, Mark's team, is going door-to-door in residential buildings, office buildings, and getting that remaining 1% of the monsters who are lurking in closets and in storerooms so that they can resettle Manhattan and bring the survivors home.
So the people who are left include the living, the Skells and the Stragglers. What are Skells?
The Skells are what we know as conventional zombies, slow moving. They gain their horrific potential in groups. And then there are stragglers, which I added to the mix. And stragglers are malfunctioning zombies. They're human statues. Once they've been infected, they go to places that were important to them, places that are emotionally charged. So if you were a lawyer, you might follow your homing instinct and go to your office and sit in your chair and wait for clients who never come. If you're a shrink, you might go to your office and wait for patients who are dead and are probably not going to show up for their 1 o'clock appointment. So downtown is littered with these stragglers, these human statues who are representing some sort of aspect of their past.
And there's something so creepy about that concept. If you were a straggler, where would you be?
Oh, probably my couch, watching the evening news and unwinding, waiting for a broadcast that's never going to come.
Right.
For a weather report that really has no impact on me.
Do the zombies in your book have any consciousness of the fact that they're zombies?
As far as the zombies, we all know what they're thinking. I doubt it's that complicated. I'm kind of hungry. Whole Foods is closed. So I'll go after this guy right here. Part of what I'm trying to do in the book is erase that line between the infected and the uninfected. The stragglers are tied to emotionally charged places in their past, and so are their survivors. They're also ghosts haunting themselves, the people that used to be, the homes, their homes that no longer exist. So whether you have the plague in your blood or not, you're kind of zombie-like, is what I'm trying to say, I think.
Now, Buffalo, New York, has become the home of the provisional government, and the best and the brightest have been sent there to rewind the catastrophe. And in return, they have a 24-hour-a-day generator and uncurtailed hot showers on command, which is a really big deal in this post-apocalyptic world. And one of the things they're tackling in the provisional government is language, trying to describe the post-plague world. They're rebranding the survival. They have specialists crafting the new language. What were some of your inspirations for this rebranding?
When I was conceiving of the novel, I just had the idea that people are pretty much the same after the disaster. They're just a little more bummed out. And so it seems that marketing will come back pretty quickly, bureaucracy, all those sorts of things. And if you are trying to marshal a very depressed populace towards a new future, you are going to need a song. Stop, Can You Hear the Eagle Roar, which is a, you know, sort of the uplifting anthem that people are humming under their breath. You're going to need a name for this new class of people, the American Phoenix, we're rising from the ashes. So it seemed that that kind of corporate sloganeering would come back pretty early, along with the desire for gourmet coffee, fresh arugula, and all those sorts of nice things that we associate with contemporary society.
So the anthem for the new world is Stop! Exclamation point. Can you hear the eagle roar? Parentheses. Theme from Reconstruction. And I love the fact that you've made the anthem a parentheses song.
Well, you know, you love those. You know, all those pop songs that are like, you're rolling me, parentheses, like a pair of dice. I thought the book would be a lot more, well, hopefully the book is gloomy, but the joke started creeping in pretty early and I had to embrace that.
So can you sing the song, the anthem?
I should probably hire a songwriter to actually make a melody. The lyrics will be fun to write. I should get on that. But it's probably close to, you know, things they play at baseball games or any sort of sports match. I don't actually go to any sports matches. Are they even called sports matches? I'm not sure.
Tennis matches.
Games. Yeah. Games.
Colson Whitehead speaking with Terry Gross. His latest novel is called Zone One. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're listening to Terry's interview recorded last October with writer Colson Whitehead. His novel Zone 1 is now out in paperback.
So why are zombies and vampires so popular now? Why do you think?
I wish I could tell you. I mean, my strange affinity goes back to when I was a kid. I read a lot of horror novels and watched a lot of horror movies, B-movies, good horror movies like The Thing, bad movies like Horror of Party Beach. And I was definitely too young to see these things. So I saw Dawn of the Dead in junior high.
That's one of the Romero films, George Romero films.
Yes, the second one, zombie classic. And it was rated X, no one under 18 admitted, but my parents took me and my brother on a family outing. It was very pleasant. And since then, I've had zombie anxiety dreams. I've had zombie anxiety dreams for the last 30 years. And this book started from a dream I had 2.5 years ago. Finally, one of my dreams was useful. I was out in the country with some house guests. It was very lovely. And I had this dream that I wanted to go out into the living room of my house, but I was wondering if they'd swept the zombies out yet. And then I woke up, and usually when you have a dream and you're sort of aware of it's a dream and you think, I have to remember this when I wake up, it's going to be a good book, and then we wake up and it's terrible. This time I woke up and thought, this is a real actual logistical nightmare. How do you get rid of the zombies when you're trying to rebuild society? And that's how the book started for me.
So your parents took you to see Dawn of the Dead, even though it was rated X. And it was rated X because it was so graphic. I mean, the zombies are like eating, like they're just like chewing on legs and arms. It's really, really gory film. And you had zombie nightmares ever since. So did your parents do the right thing or the wrong thing by taking you to see that exceptionally gory zombie film?
I got a book out of it.
30 years later.
30 years later. So it paid off. I mean, I think we didn't have babysitters, my brother and I. We would just go to Crazy Eddie, which was an old video store in New York City, every Friday and rent Betamax tapes of late 70s splatter movies and classic horror movies, Dario Argento, and have these horror film festivals. And until college, I wanted to write horror novels. I wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. Basically, if you took any Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, that was sort of my aspiration.
So when you were young, you wanted to write The Black, The Shining, or take any Stephen King novel and put The Black in front of it. So what's going on racially in your new novel? Is your character African-American? Is he white? Is race an issue? Is it a post-racial world in the post-apocalyptic world?
The use of the word post-racial is so funny these days. Folks think that because Obama was elected, suddenly racism disappeared the day after on November 6th. And of course it didn't. We don't live in a post-racial world. However, it seems when folks have the apocalypse on their plate, or at least it seemed to me, that racial differences, class differences, your funny accent, these things aren't as important as finding that last can of peas and maybe a bag of beef jerky that will get you through a couple days' food.
And making sure that the person isn't a zombie.
Yes, that helps. Yeah. That helps.
Right.
So Zone 1 is a post-racial world, simply because they have more things on their mind than skin color, gender difference.
Now, when you were growing up in Manhattan, you went to prep school. And you said you were often the only African-American in the room. And when you'd go to a bar mitzvah, which you did a lot growing up in Manhattan.
It was a great time. I mean, that was my introduction to chicken on skewers, finger food. I look back very fondly.
Little egg rolls?
Yes. Oh, God.
So how did that shape your sense of what it meant to be black?
It didn't shape my sense of what it is to be black. It helped with my outsiderness. And I think if you're an outsider, as you are in a predominantly white prep school, you become an observer. But that kind of otherness can be found in so many sectors of daily experience. And I try to tackle that in Sag Harbor. We have this prep school kid who divides his time between New York City, where he's in a mostly white environment in school, and an African-American community in Sag Harbor in the Hamptons, a middle-class, upper-middle-class enclave. And he toggles back and forth between an all-black society and a mostly white society and tries to figure out who he is and who he's becoming.
In Sag Harbor, your semi-autobiographical novel about summering in the Hamptons in an African-American summering community there, the character describes his parents as being from the uplift the race category. And I'm wondering if you would describe your parents that way, too. And if so, how did that relate to their expectations of you?
There's some of that in their personality. You know, they're the civil rights generation, and I'm the product of their struggles and what they and their aspirations and what they wanted for their kids. And they're the product of their parents' strivings, being the first doctors, lawyers in their family, this newly emergent black middle class in the 20s. So they had certain, I think, you know, they wanted me to have a decent job and make a lot of money. And when I told them I wanted to be a writer, they weren't incredibly psyched. I mean, I was fortunate to get a job working at the Village Voice and supporting myself doing journalism. Not supporting myself in a very lofty style, but I had money for beer, and that helped. And even when I was being a journalist, they sort of didn't understand and assumed I would get with the program and become a lawyer. I didn't. I started writing novels. The first one didn't go anywhere. And I think it wasn't until my first book, The Intuitionist, came out that they were fully on board. They could actually see a review of it in a newspaper and say, oh, it's actually something that's real. And even if you didn't go into investment banking or brain surgery, he can take care of himself.
There's an incident that happens in your novel, Sag Harbor, and I was wondering if this is based on anything that happened to you. The main character, who's African-American, is with some kids who are white. One of the white kids drags his finger across the main character's cheek and said, look, it doesn't come off, referring to his color. And, you know, the kid tells the incident to his father, and the father gets really angry that his son didn't hit the white kid, that his son just kind of took this insult, which the father considered the equivalent of calling the kid the N-word. So is that based on a real incident?
I would say based. You know, I think, you know, my father's upbringing was definitely more rough and tumble, and I think you become more aware of those tiny insidious moments where the world is teaching you what it actually thinks of you. I grew up with, you know, great friends, went to a school or with the same, you know, gang of kids from kindergarten on, and was definitely insulated from certain realities, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. So in Sag Harbor, I was trying to pick out small moments like that, things that happened to my friends, happened to me, and slow them down and unpack them and try to deconstruct what's going on in these moments of real racial animosity, but also just racial misunderstanding. Some white folks don't understand that actually black people don't like to having their hair padded. It's just hair. It's just an afro. You find it springy. Wow, that's great. Don't touch me. So I did endure a certain amount of head padding as a kid, and trying to like figure out what's going on in folks' brains when they reach out and touch your afro was sort of a fun part of writing Sag Harbor.
One of your first book jobs, perhaps your very first book job, was working at the Village Voice, the first, I think it's fair to say, the first really big alternative weekly newspaper. And you were, what, assistant book review editor? Or assistant to the book review editor?
Yeah, I was about 6 months out of college, and it was my job to open the 40 books a day we got from publishers, file them, answer the phones. I had to get a phone voice because I was a big mumbler, so voice literary supplement. that was a real milestone for me. And, I mean, it was a great time and a great opportunity. I'm not sure how kids find journalism jobs these days, but because, you know, the Village Voice thought of itself as a writer's paper, if you hung around and badgered folks you would get an assignment, and if it was okay, you'd get a second one. And so I started off in the TV section because the editor seemed like an easy mark, and he gave me an assignment, and that led to other stuff. So I never took any creative writing classes in college. I tried to audition for them, and I was turned down both times, which was very depressing. But I became a writer at The Voice, filing once a week. If you write a good article, you get great feedback. Good job, Coulson. If you are too self-indulgent and spend the first four paragraphs talking about your romantic woes or why you're depressed, you hear nothing, so you know you sort of screwed up and maybe you should not be so voice-oriented and more attentive to the job at hand. And that gave me the confidence to start writing fiction, even though I'd only written maybe, four stories in my whole life.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a lot of fun. Got me out of the house. Always a big plus in my world.
Are you still a shut-in?
Yeah, you work at home. You're right, you work at home. So those are the rhythms of my days.
And that suits you?
Yes, I like it just fine.
Coulson Whitehead speaking with Terry Gross in October. Whitehead's novel, Zone One, is now out in paperback. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews on local AC repair, landscapers, doctors, and others based on member experiences at angieslist.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new live recording by saxophonist Jesse Davis, whose playing, he says, comes straight out of Charlie Parker's playbook. Also, Latin band leader Eddie Palmieri. He's just received a Jazz Master's Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Pianist Eddie Palmieri has been given many nicknames. He's been called the Latin Monk because of his Thelonious Monk-inspired dissonances. He's been called the Madman of Latin Music. And soon he'll be a nationally recognized jazz master, accepting the highest national honor that the country bestows on jazz artists by the National Endowment for the Arts. Palmieri has taken many of the innovations of modern jazz pianists and brought them into his Latin bands, but he's never stopped playing good dance music. He grew up in New York, where his parents moved from Puerto Rico, and played timbales in his uncle's band when he was a teenager. His brother Charlie Palmieri, who died in 1988, was also a great Latin pianist. Eddie Palmieri has been leading his own jazz salsa groups since 1961. Terry Gross interviewed Eddie Palmieri in 1994. He told Terry about growing up in a large Puerto Rican family in the Bronx.
When my relatives all came to Puerto Rico, my uncles on... My grandmother, for example, had an open house policy, you know, which meant that on Saturdays, you would see my grandmother going down to the Safeway A&P and doing the shopping. And plus, she would stop at the liquor store and bring about, oh, 6 or 8 bottles of different ryes and rums, whatever, merely because my grandfather was also a professional gambler. So on Saturday night, Friday night, the card games would start, and by midnight on Saturday, there was no liquor stores open, and the only one that had the liquor was Grandma, and as she sold you a liquor, she would light up a cigar. And then my grandfather was quite unique in playing, so he would clean up, and they would have a house kitty. And on top of that, my uncles who worked in the leather factories, they would bring my grandfather, these armbands and suspenders that he would put on with a little hammer and a copper cup there. He would put the little brass tips on them, and that was how he made his living. And on Saturdays, all my uncles would get together, and then they would take out the guitars, and they would start to sing. By 13, I was already playing drums with my uncle, Chino Gates, y su alma tropical, because I didn't want to play the piano anymore. I wanted to become my brother's drummer.
Now, I know when you were growing up, your mother really wanted you to play piano, but you wanted to play drums.
Right.
Let's start with your mother wanting you to play piano. Why was she so big on that?
Well, because she passed the Depression here, and actually, in 1929, she was here already. She arrived in 25. And a lesson was 25 cents, and the idea was you could, you know, try to get the 25 cents. With $1.25, they made a whole grocery shopping. It's amazing what happened in the years of the Depression. And because my brother was already playing piano, and he's 9 years older than me, then my mother certainly insisted on me to play piano too, and I did. And I couldn't thank her, you know, enough for that.
Now, you studied classical music when you were young, right, on the piano?
Well, because of Miss Margaret Bond. She was a classical concert player, and by 11, I gave a concert recital at Carnegie Hall Recital Hall. But remember, all those years, from 11 to 12, I just wanted to play drums. So it hurt me from not really getting into the fundamentals of the instrument as I need to and I do now.
Did you resent having to play classical music?
No. I just didn't want to play the piano at all. I mean, I wanted to play drums, and you know, you have to contemplate like what's going through my mind. Because I want to play stickball in the street, you know, and the guys are calling me downstairs. Come on, Eddie. Come on, Daddy. You know, and I gotta be playing scales, you know, and then trying to, you know, like make my, you know, cheat on my scales. And my mother had an incredible ear. I call her Mama Ear Chops. I mean, she could hear. She said, "Hey, you know, that don't sound right, you know, an extra 15 minutes, oh, and things like that." And I was missing the game, and I was the first baseman. And then I had to become the manager, because if I wasn't the manager, probably they won't let me play.
So when you were playing timbales in your uncle's band, what was the atmosphere like? You were, I don't know, 13 or 14,
oh,
and he was
yeah.
playing in dance halls? Or?
Yeah, dance halls and up in the Villas. The Villas is like the Borscht circuit, you know, the Catskills here. You know?
You were playing in the Borscht Belt when you were 13 or 14?
No, but in the Spanish ones.
They were the Spanish Borscht Belt.
Yeah, they were owned by Spaniards at that time. That was where they call them La Villas. And
This is in the Catskill Mountains of New York, where a lot of summer resorts are?
This Plattekill, off Newburg.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I started working up there in 1950, 51. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable.
So what was the atmosphere like? What kind of people did you meet?
Well, I'll give you an idea. When the first day I got there, I went to see the pool. They told me they had a pool in this villa, and I went to see the pool. There was a cow drinking and one in the pool.
A cow?
Yeah.
What was a cow doing drinking from the pool?
Well, I don't know. I didn't know her name was Elsie at that time, so I didn't, you know, from Borton's Milk. The main thing is that that was the cows that gave you the milk. For $35, you could stay a week at the villa's room and board, and that fresh milk pitcher was there in the morning. And then my uncles and my grandfather would love to go up there because they could gamble up there. They could play cards all day long or dominoes, and that was their world. And my uncle was booked as the music of the villas, and I was part of that. So that was the way we made our living.
Did you drink when you were young?
No, but my uncle certainly did. And I always tried to, like, grab a drink or so, you know, but it was difficult because all my aunts were there and they were tattletaling my mother.
Right.
My mother.
Pianist and bandleader Eddie Palmieri speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Terry's 1994 interview with pianist and Latin bandleader Eddie Palmieri. He was recently given a Jazz Master's Award by the National Endowment for the Arts.
When you were young, you played with Tito Rodriguez. What did you learn about showmanship and running a band from watching him?
He was the one. He was the dandy. He was the dandy because no one dressed like him.
How did he dress?
Oh, immaculately, man. So hip, and he was so sharp. The orchestra, all uniform, because he was the best singer that we had here as far as a rumbero singer of an orchestra leader, and he had the preparation to do it, and he just kept improving constantly because of his competitive edge and that he always had with Mr. Tito Puente. If Tito Puente played vibes, Tito Rodriguez went to learn how to play vibes, you know. It was one of those things that he just couldn't stand. One, mostly Tito Rodriguez towards Tito Puente. There was something that just irked him, you know. But when I was working with him from the year 58 to 60, I certainly learned the tremendous amount from Mr. Tito Rodriguez. And may he rest in peace, but he knows that he's in my heart.
What did you wear in the band?
All different kinds of uniforms. Sometimes we looked like waiters, you know, and they would ask us for a drink and that, and I would give them my drink and take the tip or something like that. The main thing is, or tuxedos, but we worked because with Tito at that time, then we didn't stay working in what they call the circuit. He went to Vegas, and we did Vegas, and he had a show. His wife was Oriental Japanese, and she sang, and he had a Cuban dancer, Malta, and we did he was after that Desi Arnaz, Lucille Ball movement, since he knew Desi, and he knew Lucille Ball because his wife also came from one of those show cabarets. But he was so sharp, you know, and he could dance, and the thing was he could sing.
Dime cuando tú verás que te adoro tanto y tanto. No sé si tú lo sabrás que eres mía y nada más. Cuando tú lo notarás, me pregunto cuándo y cuándo. Si me miras al pasar, mis ojos te lo dirán. El tic-tac del reloj.
When did you feel ready to form your own band?
1960, after I left Tito Rodriguez, it took about a year. And then by 1961, I started my different forms of orchestra. But La Perfecta started in late 61, which was the orchestra then that stood together for 7-8 years. And we had two trombones, flute, wooden flute, and timbales, conga, bass, singer, and I, with a total of 8.
Were trombones unusual for a Latin band?
At that time, yes. They called us like the sound of the roaring elephants.
So did when people compared your sound to elephants, was that in praise?
Oh, well, in praise and in annoyance. You know, it was a combination of both because we were playing up in the Catskills for 3 summers with that orchestra, and that's a really commercial a setting, and the orchestra certainly didn't belong there, but we needed to be there because that was the way we would be able to maintain our status in the city by being away for the summer. Like Machito would go to the Concord, and Tito Puente would go to the President Hotel in Swan Lake or whatever, and we landed up in Kutch's Country Club, and then I landed up in Brown's, and then I landed up eventually in 65 in the Raleigh Hotel, and that's where they called us the Roaring Elephants.
Now, a lot of the hotels that you mentioned had primarily Jewish clientele vacationing there.
Right.
So were you used to seeing people who weren't Latin doing the cha-cha, the mambo, and everything? And I wonder what you thought of their dancing.
Oh, no, of course, because in the 50s, remember that the Jewish clientele was the clientele in the Palladium on Wednesdays.
Oh.
And what we saw was not only the Jewish clientele dancing to the most incredible dances that you can find, but you saw Marlon Brando there. You saw him playing bongos with Tito Puente. I mean, you saw things in the 50s you wouldn't believe. And then the mambo with Tito Puente again and Tito Rodriguez and Machito. These were great orchestras that the Jewish clientele followed. On Friday and Saturday, the Palladium was more Hispanic. And on Sunday, it was definitely Black. So we had 4 different days there that we had 4 different unique ethnic groups coming to dance, and they all danced superbly.
I want to play one of your classic recordings. I want to play Puerto Rico.
Oh, I love it. We just did that in Puerto Rico just now.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, let me play an early recording of it. And this is my guest, Eddie Palmieri, his band. He's featured, of course, on piano. What stage were you at when you recorded that?
Oh, I was in quite an incredible stage, always with the economical pressures around you. But I found myself in Puerto Rico, walking on the beach and looking at that beautiful ocean. And that's what the lyrics say. Isla linda bonita con su aguas bendita. You know, beautiful island with your blessed waters surrounding you. So that's a special album and a special year you play for me.
In Latin music, there's a lot of repetition that the piano plays. I think, is that called montuno?
That's exactly right.
So
it's a montuno part, but it's called a guajeo. You'll hear like boom, pi, boom, ping, boom, ping, boom, ping. That would be the guajeo that I'm using there, and I'll use that. The guajeros behind the percussionist, because the least amount of harmonic changes in Latin is where we get the highest degree of synchronization, which is what you're after. We simplify the chord changes, and there we get what we call el masacote, which is the synchronization of the rhythm section and the piano and bass, so that we're featuring that soloist that is showcasing himself, or that I'm showcasing on the record, or in live, you know, live presentation to the public.
Maravillosa, te canto.
I want to play something from your new album, Palmas. And you have a piece on here called Bolero Dos.
Right.
And it opens with an extended piano solo. And, I mean, there's no rhythm behind you
right.
in this piano solo, which is very unusual in Latin music. I mean, the rhythm never stops in Latin music.
Well, I've always done that since the Son of Latin Music that won the first Grammy. It's just piano alone.
Now, why do you go for that?
Oh, I mentioned that before. Is I love variations of a theme. And I know exactly what's going to come behind me, but it's such a beautiful melody that why not play with the piano first? And there's never been a piano opening or intro that has annoyed or not brought in an audience. So when you're in an audience that your rhythm can be not annoying, but certainly complicated, it's wonderful to hear a piano first. And we just, I'll just sip it in, by playing piano, and then all of a sudden, then I'll go into my orchestra, and it's been very, very well accepted, and I love to do it, and it's more pianistic, so it's it helps me in my direction of getting to know my instrument better and better.
Well, let's hear the beginning of Bolero Dos. This is Eddie Palmieri on piano. We could hear you growl on that song.
I told you, I warned you.
how did you start growling like that?
Well, let me tell you what happened. My first recording, we started to record years ago. First recording, Allegri. And all of a sudden, I see the owner walking with the engineer, and he walks in, and I said, what's the goes, what is that? What is what? And we start looking for something that nobody can, what is what? And we start looking. Sure enough, we go back to record, and he comes back, and, what is that? And finally they found out it was me. So then they didn't know what to do with me. Either gag me or put some kind of they wanted to gag me. Either that or put, cover the piano. And they did everything with the piano until later on in the other recordings, different, it said, let it be. That's the way he sounds. And that's him. Let it go. Let it go. What are they going to do? Don't gag him. You probably choke him.
Were you aware of the fact that you growled before the engineer mentioned it?
Not like that. It's really your proof is when you hear it back. You say, what is that? But it's just that inner, that spirit inside. And it gives me like some kind of an ambience for myself when I play. And it helps. And I just can't help it. It's just me.
Eddie Palmieri, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear Terry, and I want to wish you the best in the city of brotherly love, and now after talking to you, it's sisterly love.
Pianist and Latin bandleader Eddie Palmieri speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994. Palmieri has been selected for a Jazz Master's Award by the National Endowment for the Arts. The other 2013 NEA Jazz Masters are pianist and singer Mose Allison, saxophonist Lou Donaldson, and Lorraine Gordon, who runs the Village Vanguard nightclub in Manhattan. They'll be honored in a ceremony and concert at the Lincoln Center in January. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new live recording from the Jesse Davis Quintet. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Alto saxophonist Jesse Davis came out of New Orleans and began recording under his own name in the 1990s. He also made a few albums with trumpeter Nicholas Payton and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, and he appeared in Robert Altman's film Kansas City. In the last few years, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Jesse Davis has attracted less attention than he might because he's been living in Verona, Italy. But he did make a live album in New York last winter. Here's Kevin's review.
Many jazz musicians, the kind who wear jackets and ties on stage, are often carelessly referred to as playing bebop. In reality, most of them are post-boppers who build on that dynamic style that burst forth after World War II without bringing it back in pure form. It's the rare modernist who gets an authentic bebop sound on alto saxophone, who catches some of the raw explosiveness and rapid-fire grace of jazz god Charlie Parker. And then there's Jesse Davis. Jesse Davis on the 1945 ballad, I'll Close My Eyes. Charlie Parker never recorded it, but Davis's version made me check. His bluesy rasp is straight out of Parker's playbook. Ditto the way he strings unlikely notes into a pretty melody, his double-time precision, and left-field quotations from other tunes. But Davis speaks that style like a native language. He makes it his own. This music's from the Jesse Davis Quintet's album Live at Smalls, New York's other basement jazz club on 7th Avenue South, 2 minutes from the Village Vanguard. Davis's music is very New York, even if he came out of New Orleans, a city with its own bebop tradition, personified by Davis's teacher, Ellis Marcellus. But there are also traces of earlier jazz in Davis's approach. There's a bit of swing altoist Benny Carter in the way he caresses a ballad, and Davis's tune Piece of the Apple is a revamped Sweet Georgia Brown. On trumpet is his old colleague from the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, Ryan Kaiser. Giving venerable tunes a facelift is part of what jazz is about. It's an ongoing mix of old and new ingredients. Jesse Davis is no antiquarian. He brought a couple of more contemporary-sounding tunes, including Journey from the Lighthouse. His bassist and drummer are two esteemed modernists who've been meeting in studios and on bandstands for over 20 years, Peter Washington and Billy Drummond. Jesse Davis quoting there from I'm a Fool to Want You. The least known player in his quintet is pianist Spike Wilner, who runs the club where the music was recorded and the label Smalls Live that put it out. I get skeptical when the guy who signs the checks joins the band, but Wilner and Davis go way back, and the pianist acquits himself well, joining in the quotation games. Jesse Davis's Live at Smalls features unedited tunes running 10 or 20 minutes, with applause and introductions left in. Verite touches that don't wear so well on repeated listening. But the album is a good portrait of high-level nightclub jazz in our time.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com and the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Live at Smalls, the new album by the Jesse Davis Quintet on the Smalls Live label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davis.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org. From the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, why some people can't handle drinking coffee and why some babies are born with tails. Science writer Sam Keen tells the stories written by our genetic code. And we'll meet Jill Tarter. She's the scientist Jodie Foster's character in the film Contact was based on. She spent most of her career looking for signs of intelligent life in outer space. Join us.